So this is, Rick had been describing this, done in collaboration with Justin Mead, Harris Markakis, et cetera, Shibata, and Koji Uryu. I'll also mention some recent work with Tanya Hinderer, Ben Lackey, who's at UWM, and also Justin Mead, a former student at UWM, now AEI.
And if there's time, a little bit on black hole and what one might be able to get from black hole neutron star and spiral. The background for this is that behavior of matter, cold matter above nuclear density, is poorly understood. There are observations, say at RIC experiments, that look at heavy nuclei colliding with one another, and do look at the behavior of matter at high density, but the problem is that this is hot matter, and you have to extrapolate down to well below the Fermi energy for a neutron star. The matter is far from an ideal gas of neutrons, so if you're looking at a white dwarf, you can describe the white dwarf accurately as an ideal gas of electrons. That's not true for a neutron star, where the neutrons are packed together more tightly than nuclear spacing. Pressure is above nuclear density. It's what we're looking at, and a few times above nuclear density, the uncertainty in the pressure is effective on the order of 10. There are hundreds of candidate equations of state that rely on different underlying models, non-relativistic mean field, relativistic mean field, equations of state with hyperons in the core, so that you're looking at combinations not simply of up and down quarks, but of up, down, and strange quarks, possibility of pion or kaon condensates, and then free up, down, and strange quarks in as another possibility with a large bag of free quarks in the inner core of the star. So a traditional neutron star is neutrons, protons, and electrons, and some muons. And then this just shows you different possibilities inside the core of the star. And the final one that I haven't mentioned, a hypothesis first suggested by Bodmer and later independently by Witten, that the true ground state of matter at zero pressure is really strange quark matter, again, so instead of iron, large nuclei with just a single bag, again containing free up, down, and strange quarks at densities not much above nuclear density. Well, the result of this uncertainty in the behavior of matter is that the radius of a neutron star is uncertain to about a factor of 2, between about 8 and 16 kilometers for a slowly rotating neutron star. And the fact that there are so many different possible ways of grouping the quarks means that the number of parameters in different models, number of parameters per model, is typically larger than the number of astrophysical observables, and number of parameters per model times the number of models is well above the number of astrophysical observables. So if you want to try, so people have typically taken a bunch of equations of state and said, looked at whether observations just ruled them in or ruled them out with the set of equations of state that gradually shifts over the decades. To systematize the study of the equation of state, we wanted to get a parameter space. And so rather than using fundamental parameters, we need really a phenomenological parameterization with the number of parameters less than the number of expected astrophysical observables. And so smaller than that, and at the same time large enough that you can accurately model the universe of candidate equations of state, so that you can roughly, you can accurately deduce what the equation of state is if you can locate yourself in parameter space. So we talked about this, and we want to try a phenomenological parameterization. Well, if you look at the equation of state for low density and for very high density, that is for non-relativistic and highly relativistic neutrons, the free gases satisfy an equation of state that looks like PV to the gamma equals constant. So a familiar looking equation of state, or equivalently P equals K rho to the gamma, where rho is the baryon density, so that d rho over rho is minus dV over V. And curiously, the candidate equations of state themselves, so here's a group of about 20 of them, have this behavior, the similar behavior. So if you plot log P versus log rho, the equations of state typically look piecewise linear. So they curve up, but they you can approximate them in any, in a given density interval by a constant slope for log P versus log rho. So that suggests that you try modeling the equation of state by specifying d log p, d log rho, specifying the slope here at a few different densities. So we do that and then translate, have an overall pressure at somewhat at around nuclear density. So pressure at nuclear density still is unknown by a factor of about two or more. And so there's an overall translation to model this. So we allow a free parameter for the pressure over here and then free slopes. Well, there's a couple of dividing densities as well as these three slopes and the overall change in the pressure. So that is about six, that gives six parameters here. Which is large compared to number of hard astrophysical observations that one expects in the next decade. So to pare this down, we looked at the best choice of dividing densities, and happily there is a, so there are preferred low and upper dividing densities that minimize the error in matching this parameterized equation of state to the universe of candidate equations of state. And that, and then if we just fix these dividing densities, that gets us down to four parameters, the three slopes between the dividing densities and this overall shift in the pressure. So at each in each interval, we have P of rho looking like a polytrope, K of the form K rho to the gamma. So you've got three polytropes. The constants are fixed by continuity. Well, that's the parameterization. We've got three slopes, gamma 1, gamma 2, and gamma 3, at three different densities. Gamma 1 and gamma 2 are the densities you see at neutron stars below about 1.4 solar masses. So observations for binary in spiral, you typically expect to be at somewhere around there, masses below 1.5, say 1.45, 1.5 solar masses. So you're really sampling only three parameters for that. And then you get the energy from, so neutron stars are cold. That means the entropy per baryon is essentially constant throughout the neutron star. And that gives you a one-parameter equation of state. So given p is a function of rho, epsilon is a function of rho, is fixed by first law of thermodynamics, dE equals minus pdV. And so that's what this is, with epsilon, the energy density, energy over volume. So we've got d rho over rho is minus dV over V. This looks like the pdV term, dividing both sides by the volume, and then there's a term over here, the change in epsilon over V from changing the volume. So this is minus epsilon dV over V from replacing dE by dE over V. All right, so that's our parameterized equation of state. We've got now a couple of hard theoretical constraints and really only two hard observational constraints at this point. So the hard theoretical constraints are the known equation of state below nuclear density and the requirement of causality. If the velocity of sound be less than the speed of light, this is required in a perfect fluid description of a neutron star, so in order that initial data determine the evolution only within the future light cone of that data. So this is a strict requirement for causality, and it's then within a perfect fluid description, and it requires then the dp the epsilon, which is speed of sound squared, be less than 1. The hard astrophysical constraints. So the unambiguous, that is model independent observations, are that the maximum mass of a neutron star is greater than 1.7 solar masses. So there are observed neutron stars with masses of about 2.2 solar masses, but two standard deviations away from that gets you down to 1.7. And then with very high accuracy, an observed neutron star with a spin of 716 hertz. So rotating 716 times a second, and that means that the maximum rotation on neutron stars has to be larger than that. Well, of these two hard constraints, only the maximum mass significantly constrains the parameter space in order to rule out plausible equations of state. You would really need to observe neutron stars rotating faster than about 1,200 times a second. So 716 is a pretty weak constraint. It tells you the star can't be excessively stiff. If it's too stiff, the pressure is too large as a function of density, then the radius of the star is too large, and when you spin it up, the outside of the star, the equator, is rotating at the speed of a particle in circular orbit, rotating at the Kepler velocity. So that's called the Kepler, or mass shedding limit. And you can reach that at 716 hertz only for a really unusually stiff equation of state. So a radius larger than this 16 kilometers that I was talking about in the uncertainty in our neutron star radius. All right, causality, however, removes a substantial part. So people devising equations of state often put in causality by hand if they're looking at, say, non-relativistic mean field theory. So it's a significant constraint on models of equations of state. And in this diagram, it's a constraint on the higher density part, the inner part of the core. So on these two higher density slopes, gamma p, gamma 2 and gamma 3, so it limits them. They can't be too large. And you're restricted to the region underneath, in back and underneath of this surface in this equation of state parameter space. That restriction is a little weaker than what I just drew to give you an intuitive feeling. So this conforms to our expectation. The pressure at initial pressure can't be too high. Gamma 3 can't be too large. Gamma 2 can't be too large. But that's weakened by the fact that you really should only demand causality for densities below the largest density occurring in a star based on that equation of state. You can always change the equation of state above the observed density in the star to make it causal. So that restriction cuts out, so you're allowed to be in back of this. You're also allowed to be above here where the maximum mass of the star is central density is below the central density that you're looking at. Okay, so
but your star would never be in that region, or what happened there?
Yeah, so the point is that let's go back over here. To require that you have to be inside this surface, that comes from saying that if the equation of state is not inside that, then it violates causality, but it does so at a density above the maximum density in neutron stars. So you have maximum mass on neutron stars set by that equation of state. Maximum density at that maximum, at the center of that maximum mass star, and you're violating causality up here, but only at densities higher than that. So you can always shift the equation of state.
Okay.
So you keep these parameters, they describe the equation of state then
in the regime of interest,
and then above that you just change the equation of state so you satisfy causality. Another question?
So although there is a maximum density that an actual neutron star can have, isn't there a lot known about the equation of state theoretically in the high density limit? Does that not give another? Is there not another theoretical constraint?
By high density limit, you mean high enough so you're looking at free quarks?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's well above the maximum density that you have in here. So it may be that in the center of the star you have some region where you have where the quarks are free, but it's certainly below the density at which you know that to be true. And even if you have a single bag, you still have interactions between the quarks you have to worry about. So you don't know if you have quarks in a single bag, if the nucleons have dissolved, and even if they have, you don't really know the equation of state.
Is another way of saying that you wouldn't want to extend your simple parameterization to that regime, or?
No, the parameterization is purely phenomenological,
right.
So it's not supposed to. That's supposed to bias you when you could have free quarks in the core within this. It would represent a softening. So it would mean that gamma 3 is smaller.
Okay.
You have free quarks, a lot of hyperons, or condensate condensates, all of them give you a phase transition that soften gamma 3.
But couldn't you introduce a gamma 4? I mean, isn't there another way of saying that you don't know that there's not a gamma 4?
Well, that's it is. That's right. So you could have gamma 3 is picked roughly at a place where you have to worry about strange quarks. And that's roughly, and that is plausibly a place where you dissolve nucleon boundaries. So it's roughly the same place. But certainly the fact that we're only using three parameters is obviously going to constrain, in some sense, what physical things we model well. On the other hand, it looks like we, within about an error, an R RMS error of about 5%, we mock up equation, very different equations of state. Okay, so
that's that. So if we look at the combination of the of these two constraints, that the so maximum mass m greater than 1.7 solar masses is roughly opposite in its meaning to to the causality constraint, you need to be stiff enough in the core to support this mass, to support a 1.7 solar mass star. So this so that means you have to be above and in front of this surface. You have to have so the pressure has pressure at a little above nuclear density has to be higher than the surface shows shown here, and gamma 2 and gamma 3 have to be larger. So again, it's a constraint on gamma and gamma 3. It doesn't tell you much about the stiffness out about the slope when you're out in the outer part of the core. These two different, they're actually two different colors over here, and the slight difference between the two surfaces reflect extremes in choosing gamma in the outer part of the star. So it has almost no effect on that. It's basically the stiffness near the inner part of the core that's supporting, that's to support this mass.
So this is
the pressure. It's this parameter that slides the pressure up and down, the overall
concentration.
Yeah. The reason, well, I'll talk a little bit, but the reason for using that as a parameter is that that pressure at just below twice nuclear density is found to be closely tied to the radius of the neutron star, and so to the deformation of the neutron star. So we took it as an equation of state parameter that was going to be a stand-in for what you're actually measuring when you measure binary inspiral. So deviation from binary inspiral comes from deformation of the star. That's roughly tied to this parameter. That's why you're like, that's one reason for having that as the third parameter.
Does the 2 mean twice nuclear density, or does the 2 mean this gamma? Because it says large
peaks. These are the gammas.
No, on the side, in the name of the parameter, it says log of P2.
Oh, log of P2. it's P at the start of the second interval.
The second.
So it's 1.7 times nuclear density. I tried to eliminate that by using P sub asterisk, but obviously I didn't catch it in this one. Okay, so we've got these two constraints.
Speed of sound less than speed of light causality, which puts you on the inside of this guy. Maximum mass puts you on the outside of that, and so the region between the two is this shaded region. Inside this, and above this blue surface. All right, so that's what we're starting out. We've got this kind of slab in the equation of state space. And now we want to look at what we might get from future observations. So the first thing I want to emphasize here is that both of these constraints, and also the constraint that comes from maximum rotation, which is too high up to be shown on that diagram, all have the proper, for all of them, you're talking about one feature of a neutron star. So maximum mass restricts you to one side of a surface. But if you have an observation of a single mass of a single neutron star that restricts you to one side of a surface in this parameter space. If you measure, you can get two measurements of the same neutron star, then you restrict yourself to a single surface. So you have a stronger constraint, a lower dimensionality surface, and if you have a couple of measurements, then you would restrict yourself to the intersection of two surfaces. Okay, so this is, so you say observe the mass and radius, so there are claims, although I didn't include them in the hard constraints because they're quite model dependent, but claims on measuring simultaneously mass and radius of a neutron star, and then you have a constraint that looks like the radius as a function of the parameters, these four parameters, p, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, is equal to the observed radius of the neutron star for a fixed, so this, I should have stuck in a mass over here. For a given mass, the radius is a function of these three parameters, and then that has to be the observed radius. And if you're looking at a star that's less than about 1.4 or 1.5 solar masses, gamma 3 doesn't play a role. You don't get up to a density high enough for gamma 3 to cut in, and that means that you have radius as a function of observed mass, and three parameters is equal to observed radius, so that's a two-dimensional surface then in this three-dimensional parameter space. So future constraints, so that one example, you might be able to get mass and radius of a single star. One expects to get the moment of inertia and mass for the same star. One of the stars in the fastest binary pulsar system to about 10% in the next decade. So that's an expected measurement there. Then you can measure the individual neutron star masses from early binary in spiral. So you have individual masses should be significantly better than 10%, to a few percent, or maybe better than a percent. And then from the in spiral itself, what I'll be talking about is measuring the departure from a point particle waveform seen in the observed waveform from neutron star in spiral. And finally, yeah.
First one, you're just saying if we wait a few more years, we'll have enough data to get the moment of inertia?
Yeah.
So that's guaranteed, more or less.
Less. The error in it is controversial. So 10% seems to be a reasonable estimate, but it's not certain that we get it to 10%.
What's the method?
Sorry.
I knew this before the last time. So it's, you're looking at, so you have some, I guess it's a, so what is it? Maybe it's spin orbit coupling between the stars that is tied to moment inertia. So I think that's what it is. So it's some change in the orbit, some precession titles.
Okay. And finally, after merger, if the equation of state is either the masses of the neutron stars are low enough, so for a soft equation of state down around 1.2 solar masses or so, or a stiff equation of state for higher masses, you can have a star that does not, a merged star that does not promptly collapse to a black hole. So prior to collapse to a black hole, you have a star rotationally supported. You have differential rotation following the merger, and that star then oscillates. And from these oscillations, from the mode frequencies of the oscillations of the merged star, and these oscillations may persist for many cycles. So you may be able to extract accurate mode frequencies from oscillations after merger. The problem, of course, is that after merger, all of the microphysics comes into play. You have to worry about wind up of the magnetic fields. That's going to affect the rotation of the star. I mean, it'll have some direct effect on the mode because the magnetic field can be large. It can indirectly affect the mode by changing the, because the magnetic field is going to damp out differential rotation. You have to worry about neutrino transport and the rate of cooling of the neutrons of this neutron star after it forms. So although this is potentially exciting, it relies on it's very model dependent, and it's going to rely on a real understanding of the microphysics after merger. So I'm not. All right, so let's look at the signal from in-spiral of binary neutron stars. This is a diagram from Jocelyn Reed. So we've got a point particle in-spiral looking like this. So point particle, of course, you don't have point particles in general relativity. But if you look at, as many of you know, if you look at post-Newtonian point particle in spiral using the Taylor T4 version, then you have an in-spiral waveform that's, until late in-spiral, is essentially indistinguishable from the in-spiral of pairs of a binary black hole system. So we could either regard the binary black hole waveform or the point particle post-Newtonian waveform as our stand-in for a point particle waveform in general relativity, which doesn't actually exist. So that means we have essentially a well-defined point particle waveform until the last several orbits. And we can talk about departure from that waveform. And a measure of that departure then tells you how large the neutron star is and how large it measures the deformation of the neutron star. So this is point particle in spiral. This is the your familiar noise curve from advanced LIGO. So that's this cutting up here. If we look at broadband advanced LIGO, then the noise curve from that is higher in this region, but in the higher frequency region, when you're in the last few orbits, you drop down here. So you're more sensitive to the last few orbits with the broadband configuration. And so here's a typical departure for a medium equation of state from point particle in spiral. And you can see that for the broadband configuration, you're lying a little bit above it. So you can extract some information, and I'll talk about the accuracy with which you can get information from this last part of the in-spiral. And finally, this is the Einstein telescope, or proposed Einstein telescope down here. And there you have much better, of course, accuracy in figuring out the equation of state from Logan Spiral.
I would have thought that you would have had more sensitivity in distinguishing by doing mesh filtering against a black hole waveform versus in other words, instead of looking at the power, at the noise spectrum, looking at predicted black hole in spiral waveform versus predicted neutron star in spiral waveform? Are those just not?
Well, I think that's what one does. So you look at the waveform, point particle waveform, you subtract the waveform from the you have the waveform from the neutron star.
Okay, so you're not.
And then you look at that inner product as the measure of departure from point particle in spiral. That coverage, it's the noise weighted, the usual noise weighted inner product. And if you've got other parameters, you look at the matrix elements of the Fisher matrix, but in any event, that's essentially.
But that curve will move left to or right depending on masses. So for black holes, you have things coming that way. And so the merger is much clearly seen than in this case.
But I think the point is that you can get much more information by looking at the full time series rather than just the power spectrum.
I think that maybe some people are not understanding what that's just showing the noise that you have to contend with when you do these observations.
Yeah.
That's not the signal you're looking for in those curves.
The black and green are.
Let me show you what I mean. I'll tell you a little more about the data analysis in a second. So look at this for another few minutes.
Okay.
And you can ask me questions.
No, I won't be able to answer.
I suspect that's just showing the track that it follows.
All right, so just to dramatize this, there's a substantial difference, right? We said between the radius of neutron star for soft proposed equations of state and stiff proposed equations of state. And you get merger earlier and significant departure from point particle in spiral earlier by one or two orbits. So substantial difference for the last four or five cycles of the waveform. So here's a simulation.
All right, so this is a simulation by Masaru Shibata using initial data constructed by Koji Uryu and Maris Markakis. I don't know why it shifted off the road over here, but let's see. Solution. What's the zero temperature curve? Well, let me get back to that and tell you a little bit. So if you watch these things, you can see the stiffer guy over here merging earlier, the soft medium a little later, and the softer still later. If we put them together, you can compare the departure from point particle, so that's in black, with stiff in green over here. So everything coinciding early on with point particle, and then green departing from it early, medium in blue departing over here a little later, and the purple over here for the soft equation of state sticking with point particle all the way through here. All right, so that's our litany. This a little bit. Okay, so same thing over here. Here you're looking at post-merger oscillations for a stiff equation of state, and down here a soft equation of state prompt collapse after the merger can't support the something else. So clear difference in the waveforms. These are the two waveforms over here correspond to the two polarizations. Okay, so that's simulation. A larger radius requires a stiffer equation of state, and so a larger pressure at about twice nuclear density, 1.7 times nuclear density for what we're using. And so you can ask, with what accuracy can you extract this parameter? And we look at the difference between two values of the pressure over the inner product between the difference of the difference of two waveforms. And that gives you, for a broadband configuration, a log of, so the log of P star here is given up to 0.1 for the smaller pressures with an error that's a little larger than that for larger pressures. And so this is broadband. You could alternatively use narrowband, and this gives you about the same accuracy. So narrowbanding has a noise curve going down sharply in one particular frequency range. So you're insensitive to most of the latent spiral, and then you see you can sweep across a particular frequency band. If you have a lot of essentially identical in spirals, so if you have in spirals with the same mass stars, then you might think of adding together information from different narrow band, and that's not looked at over here. So these are results for a single in spiral. If you have a great many, then you could imagine doing significantly better.
You don't do a Fisher matrix with those signals, right?
No.
So you just inject the signal and different realizations of the noise sample at any time and get your let's see.
Is LIGO tunable to different frequency bands? What's the experimental situation? Are people actually planning to?
Yeah, so you can, right, you can tune it. So narrow banding is tuning it to, some band near high frequencies. So you have the usual curve and you have a dip at some high frequency. So it's sort of the opposite of broadbanding, where you're more sensitive to all high frequencies. Narrowbanding gives you much more sensitivity, but only in a narrow frequency range.
You know how they do that? I remember Peter Salzman was playing with special supports. Well, anyway,
that's signal recycling. You put a mirror in front of the photodiode, so you resend the signal back into the cavity. And there are different ways of doing this.
And make a different, by adjusting that, you tune the maximum sensitivity. I see.
Good. All right, so that's the accuracy of extracting the pressure accuracy with which we extract the radius. For a radius of about 10, you would get radius within about a little over half a kilometer. Radius of about 13 kilometers, you get it to within about 2 kilometers. Again, for a single observation. About the same accuracy for narrow banding. So fairly hopeful figures for advanced LIGO. And then just wanted to mention a couple of other things before the end of the talk. So there was work done by Peter Flanagan and Tiny Hinderer, and related papers by Winnington and Eric and Deborah and Nagar, looking at departure from point particle in spiral of the early in spiral. So you have much smaller departure, but a large amount of signal to look at. And the question is, how well you do for that. So this, so if you're at large, large separation, then each star is nearly spherical, and you, the field of one star on the other deviates from the sphere by its quadrupole moment. So you have a quadrupole perturbation on the spherically symmetric background at large separation. And so you can figure out what the effect will be by looking at the distortion of a spherical star in a quadrupole field.
So you put, take a spherical, look at a perturbation of Schwarzschild, you have a spherical star, you put in a quadrupole field, quadrupole boundary conditions of infinity. So if you think of a Newtonian star, you'd be looking at a star immersed in the potential that at infinity looked like had a Y2 behavior, a YLM behavior with L equals 2 out at infinity. And instead of, and it's a solution to Laplace's equation, so instead of falling off like 1 over R cubed, an imposed field, there's a quadrupole field that rises like R squared at infinity. So you impose this quadrupole field, and then you ask for that imposed field, what is the induced quadrupole moment, which you can again measure asymptotically as the 1 over R cubed contribution to the field that comes from the deformation of the star. So that relationship, so you have an imposed field Eij, Xi, Xj, quadratic in the Cartesian coordinates. So symmetric straight-through tensor over here giving you the background imposed quadrupole field, and then an induced quadrupole moment on the neutron star, which you can again calculate asymptotically as the change in the really the quadrupole here for perturbation of Schwarzschild. It's just a quadrupole change in GTT, in the potential that corresponds to the Newtonian potential. So the induced quadrupole moment is proportional to the imposed quadrupole moment times the radius of the neutron star to the fifth times a constant which is dimensionless and is called the Love number. So there's a Love number for every multiple moment, and this is the one associated with all of these two. Well, surface, so then we can ask, suppose if that's what you're measuring at large distances, then we can look at the, so this constant over here, this kr to the fifth is going to be called lambda in a minute. And what we're looking at is surfaces of constant lambda in our parameter space. So if you, so again, you've measured the, assume you've measured the masses of the neutron star, and then you have the intersection of this surface with that slab, this surface with the slab of allowed equation of state space. So how does this look? If you've got a soft equation of state, the star has small radius, and this goes like radius to the fifth, so very small lambda, very small quadrupole deformation. And if you have a stiff equation of state, the radius is significantly larger, and lambda is larger still by a by this greater factor because it depends on the radius of the fifth power. So we go up from 6 times 10 to the 35th up to 10 to the 37 gram centimeter squared for this induced quadrupole moment. And the finally, we can look at observability in early N-spiral. So this is taken from this work by Hinderer, Ken Hinderer, Justin Reed, and Ben Mackey. And then there's similar work simultaneously by a student, Ryan, of Scott Hughes. and I think that will ultimately be appropriate. So this, so the, well, you, so lambda here varying from 0.5 to 9, so by more than an order of magnitude, but the observability, the error in lambda is, for advanced LIGO, is comparable to the size of LIGO. So you're not, so from advanced LIGO, it does not look like you're going to get from the early in spiral. Well, again, possibly, I mean, again, this is a single in spiral, so I have, so not looking at the statistics of the great many in spirals, but harder to deduce from the early in spiral much about the star, the error bars and those. Even though there's this large effect from the equation of state, going like the radius to the fifth power, the error is still large.
For the black hole neutron star case, but do you have any estimate of where that's the case and how?
I see for a departure from early in spiral.
No, I'm close to the.
On late in spiral, I mean, this is. We're talking about, I'm just talking about early in spiral. So late in spiral, we did much better, right? So from the numerical simulations of late in spiral, you can really, and so there was some effect of Love number, which is similar to this, to finding P star, and there you can much better, you can genuinely restrict yourself to to a tenth or something so this is just saying from the early end spiral, you're not doing nearly as well as you're doing from the late end spiral. And from and again from Einstein telescope, you finally are getting down to so the delta log lambda, there should be no 10 to the 36 here anymore, but this looks like 0.93. So you've got so
doing significantly better for black hole neutron star in spiral. I don't have much to say about it. Well, let's see.
2 minutes to go, which is just about right. You can again
obtain a surface in equation of state space by measuring the departure of neutron star black hole waveform from point particle in spiral. These are in spirals here shown for work from a group in Kyoto with Shibata and Taniguchi at UWM. And here, so we've got these pretty looking waveforms up here, but I think the difficulty then comes in the variety. So there's a number of difficulties, but you have to extract many parameters from the in spiral. So for neutron star in spiral, you've basically got the masses of neutron stars. The spins are essentially irrelevant. So the typical spins, you're vastly below factor of 100 or more in the late in spiral for observed spins of binary pulsars below the deformation due to induced quadrupole moment. Here you have to worry about the spin of the black hole and the orbit of the neutron stars. You have a variety of different orbits that you have to worry about. You've got to identify what orbit you're in. You've got to worry about the spin of the black hole. The data analysis for that is much more difficult. It hasn't been done yet. And I think it's an open question. What you can actually get out because of the difficulty in extracting all of the parameters of the system before you can figure out what you mean by what point particle and spiral you're talking about. Okay, so that's that comment. And then, right, thank you.
Well, starting at up to which light frequency? So it starts at so let's see, this is what it looks like. So I think though they're looking only, so they're starting at 450 and then going, so presumably going up to end of the curves over here. So they must be cutting off, there must be a cutoff at the observed cutoff for each equation of state from merger, I think there must be an earlier cutoff, but I don't know the answer.
Yeah, if you really want, I mean, if you're really going up the merger, you're deforming quite a bit.
Yeah, so then, I mean, then it would be dominated by the late stuff. So I can't.
So I understood a lot of these. You just do, you observe one merger and you get a constraint on your parameter. So they'll be seeing many mergers, right? So that'll be a lot of consistency checks on the whole, on your fitting, on your choice of phenomenological parameters. So.
Yeah, so if you see, if you see 100 mergers in the, or a couple hundred mergers in a couple of years, then your statistics should be, you should have significantly better accuracy.
Yeah, I mean, how many mergers would you have to see just to plot out the equation of state without having any phenomenological parameters? Is that helpful?
I think that's, I don't think you can do that with advanced LIGO. Your range of masses is restricted. Probably, you might have a range between 1.2 and 1.6. Probably not much beyond that. So there's a piece of the equation of state space that you might hope to plot out. We have not yet done the analysis for what happens if you have 100, or say 20 nearly equivalent mass pairs.
Or even not equivalent, because you're assuming it's the same equation of state for every.
It's the same equation of state. That's right.
So they don't even have to be equivalents.
Yeah.
So just a naive question, partly related to that, is there some reason why it has to be universal? Could not one find from 100 mergers maybe two different kinds of neutron stars obeying different equations of state? Isn't this logically possible?
Yeah, it's logically. So you could. So it's logically possible, for example, that you could have a class of strange quark stars and a class of neutron stars.
Yes, for example. There's nothing forcing.
That would be the most common suggestion for how that could happen, and that's certainly right. So it's logically possible. I mean, in that particular case, I think if you have enough strange quark stars that you see one in a binary system, then it means that early in the universe you've had a merger of a strange quark star with another strange quark star or with a neutron star, and that should have distributed in one strange quark star. If you distributed it through the universe, you could see 10 to the 22 universes, 10 to the 22 visible universes with the density so that you'd have one strangelet per nascent neutron star.
And with that density, with one strange lit, the neutron star converts to a strange star. So it's hard to have strange stars in a large, enough strange stars that you would ever see one, and not have every neutron star be a strange star. But
there's a lot of unknowns here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Huh? Right. So it's
okay.
But that was presumably shown up, because there were two really distinct classes in the equations of state.
Yeah. There could be two distinct classes, and the data could say, unless there's some, I mean, how compelling is it theoretically that you've got to be all one or all the other?
I think not at all.
That's what I thought. So you could see a bimodal or trimodal. Or,
right. In fact, it would help things in some cases. There's different cooling rates. When people don't, and you don't know, I mean, they might simply be related to different masses, but you could certainly explain, observe puzzles with different cooling rates of different neutron stars by saying they're actually.
I agree, it's messier than we might like the universe to be, but on the other hand, our knowledge of nuclear matter at these densities is still for time. Okay.
Have people compared with the constraints? If Lisa saw a neutron star get shredded by as it plunged into a 10 to the 5 solar mass black hole or something like that, how well would they
get shredded? If it's 10 to the 5 solar masses, it doesn't get shredded.
How small does it have to be to shred?
Under 10, certainly under 10 solar masses.
Oh, sorry, 10 to the 5 is for a main sequence star get shredded.
Probably has to be below 5 or 6 solar masses. Well, use the number 5 or 6 solar masses before you totally disrupt it.
When you compare the numerical waveform with the T4, are you assuming that you have the masses exactly the same?
That
you measure the masses. Because in a real surge,
so the masses are identical to each other, but there's an additional. I mean, you've got an accurate Church mass, you have a less accurate mass ratio, the errors I've shown are essentially errors for a single event, where you have not taken account of the error in mass ratio.
Because that could be quite large in a match filtered search for a bank there in Utah.
We can talk about this. I have some quoted figures that get you down to, oh, here they are. Okay, so this is, so we've got chert mass and this essentially reduced mass over here, right? This says less than 1% is the claim for events like the reduced mass, whatever. Up here, right? This is not Curtis Williams. Somebody, you know, he's the. This paper, which is again going out of this analysis. So, certainly much better for chert mass, but still accurate. I mean, the accuracy here is much better than the accuracy that you can expect for what we were extracting, right? Where we've got a 10% error at best in extracting the radius by this pressure. So if this is right, it's not affected by the, it's not significantly affected by accuracy measuring the adjustments.
Okay, so no other questions. John is going to be here till tomorrow night, so leaving.
Yeah, I'll be here on Saturday too.
Okay, thanks, John, again.